Welcome to the airport lounge. Table for two gentlemen? Right this way. Here's your booth. Have a great show.
Welcome to the Airport Lounge, the Winnipeg Jets podcast, much like Dominic Ducharme's mask, usually off. I'm Mike Guthrie, and I'm joined by my good friend and Manitoba Parks website director, Vaughn Mitchell. How's it going, Vaughn?
I've been very busy lately. That website doesn't crash itself.
I figured it took some real doing to get that shoddy a product and service in place. Congratulations to you.
At least we know we're not the shittiest thing on the internet.
I think that should be our tagline. So we've got a really special one today, I think. We have an interview with Todd McCullough. NBA star Todd McCullough has joined us, and we talk a little hockey, a little basketball, and generally just, I think, have a good time. So we're going to play that right away. We have a bit of housekeeping up in front, and then after the interview, if those are still interested, we're going to break down last week's play from the Winnipeg Jets and then look ahead a bit to the future. Does that sound good?
Sounds awesome. This is definitely the episode of thanks. I've got a couple housekeeping notes myself. I'd like to extend my personal thanks to my good friend John Mackey for listening. He sent me a cash contribution to support the Men's Sartorial Society, which it's cash. I promise I'll pass it along.
I was going to say, so, I haven't seen anything.
Yeah, thanks, John, and keep the money coming. I'd like to thank our buddy Dan in Vancouver for listening.
Dan,
his only request is that we work in a couple of that goddamn Steen references into the podcast, which was something his dad often said when watching Jets 1.0. So consider it done, Dan. In fact, I was thinking I might transition the Antropov trivia theme into that goddamn Steen category. So we're looking forward to some sponsorship money from First Mining Gold, which Dan may work for. So
yeah, and speaking of mining, I think we bind the Antropov trivia to its fullest extent. I was looking at it the other day. I'm like, I don't know how much more we can pull from this, because I think we've covered it. And super quick before we get to Todd, is that we do we're really the old guys, right? Like we had a Twitter account. We now have a Facebook account. And yeah. So it's at the Airport Lounge. If anybody's interested, us two dinosaurs, we have a TikTok. There's nothing posted. And I have to say, like, my daughter wants to join TikTok, which it's not going to happen. But it's a whole new world over there that I don't think either you or I are equipped to deal with efficiently or accurately. But it is something that we're looking to expand the social media platform or profile. Sorry.
Yeah, it will likely be an awkward, you know, two
super
steps
awkward
forward, fall down, three steps back. You know, I just kind of stare at Facebook and it just sort of looks back at me and says, "You do not belong here."
Get out of here! What? Get off!
No. Show me how you do that. I want to learn it. I'm not leaving until you teach me. Get
on! We'll see if we can make that interesting in some way. But yeah, so why don't we get going with the interview with Todd? It's super engaging, and it was really fun to do. And we'll talk some Jets after that.
For sure. And so without further ado, here's Todd McCullough. And thank you, Todd, for doing this. Well, we here at the Airport Lounge are very excited and, quite honestly, very flattered that we have our first guest, and that our first guest is my good friend and former NBA star, Todd McCullough. Todd was a prolific high school basketball player and then took his talents to the University of Washington. There he led the Division I in field goal percentage for three straight years, and I think only a handful of other players have ever done that before, and was all Pac-10 first team for his final 2 years. He was drafted into the NBA by the Philadelphia 76ers, and while he was in the NBA, played for the 76ers and the Nets, and played in back-to-back NBA finals, going up against the likes of Shaquille O'Neal and others. He's a multiple national team member and an Olympian in 2000, where that team was a bit of an upstart. And I always say he is the softest hands and the best scoring touch of any big man NBA player I've ever seen and played with, but I've only played with one, so that's probably a small sample size. So, without further ado, Todd McCullough, how's it going, buddy?
I'm good, Mike. Thanks. That was that's a wonderful introduction. And I now that my career's over, I have to introduce myself now. So I come down, I'm like, and now your starting daddy weighing in at 2 pounds. He wanted to be a surfer. I don't think he can do it. Let's give it up for Big Todd. Let's get ready for school. So I have to introduce myself now. So that was nice of you to do that. Thank you.
You bet. So we're going to talk a little hockey, a little basketball. Get your takes on what it's like being a professional athlete and some of the mythos behind that. I did, if I could, and I promise, then I will stop talking for the duration. But Todd and I grew up together, and I have a story, and Todd and I have not either privately or publicly sort of rehash this out, but when we were 16, Todd, myself, and our friend Chris Manalastis were at Grand Park Mall, and Todd and Chris, and I can't remember the context through which, but they went to go into Grand Park, and I was left in the passenger side, and my recollection is that the car was running, and for some reason, it had something to do with the radio. I couldn't get the radio working, and in my infinite wisdom, I had no idea about stick shift, about standard. But I thought, oh, I think you have to press on the clutch to get things going. And so Todd, like you're supposed to, had left it in gear. And so I reached over the passenger seat in onto the driver's seat, sort of straddling the two. And I pressed down on the clutch and I got the results that I wanted. And then I pulled it up and the car immediately jumped. Now, if I had just done nothing from there on, there's no story. But again, in my brainiac ways, I panicked and I started pumping my foot, again, straddling the two seats, trying to hit the brakes, but I hit the gas about 2 or 3 times and I went over the guardrail because we were parked right in front of Grant Park, and I went over the guardrail, and this is for you kids, there used to be things called video stores, and there was a jumbo video, and it was an all glass outside facing the walkway. And so I jumped, and I missed that, hitting that glass by about 3 inches, but I went careening over and smashed into Grant Park, the actual building, and hit a utility door, and then it bounced back, and the whole car was rocking, and then I was completely stunned, and I looked over, and Todd and Chris were coming out from the thing, and you'll know, Todd is the nicest person in the world, and he always even keeled, and he dropped to his knees and put his hands on his face, and I just was sitting in sheer stun, and there were people, because it was a walkway. Like, I could have killed multiple people, and also I could have gone right through the jumbo video door, and I wouldn't have stopped. I would have just kept hitting the gas. Like, I could have gone right into Grant Park Mall. And so, and then we get in, Todd has to drive his car and, 7-point turn it because I've got it perpendicular to the walkway. And so we drive home and we get to Todd's place. And again, Todd's dad, also one of the nicest people you're ever going to meet. Always happy. Never a bad thing to say about anybody. And he's in the garage and he's got a bunch of life jackets. He's rearranging the garage. And we pull up. And I sort of get, I kept Todd, I can't remember if you told it or I told it, but the look on his face, and I was like, I'm going to get murdered by the nicest man on the planet. I'm breaking records here. And he tossed, I think about it now, I remember at the time I was terrified, and he threw, he got mad for a second, threw the life jackets, and then was calm, and then I think you guys took me home and explained it to my parents. And it got, again, after that, the details get a bit foggy. But I remember that for years, I would wake up in sweats because the end parts of my dream had me crushing 80-year-old ladies or carrying them on Todd's hood into Grant Park Mall. And that story talked, I've never lived that down. Like, anytime anybody had a stick shift, it was, hey, Mike, you want to get up here and drive? I formally apologize to you, Todd, and I hope your dad listens to this. I formally apologize to him as well. It was just one of those experiences as a 16-year-old where, I've got goosebumps right now because it could have gone, and it didn't. We got the cars got fixed, but Anyway, did I manufacture, or is my recollection anywhere close to what your experience was?
It was very similar. So we were there for Jumbo Video. I had rented some videos, and they needed to be returned. For you young kids, there was a thing called a video store, and there were some serious late fees if you didn't return them. And so we had to return them, and there was a long line. So you and I and Chris were all inside there, but we had to wait like 15 people deep to pay. And you were like,
right.
Yeah, I think I want to listen to the radio. Can I have the keys? And I was like, yeah, sure. What could possibly happen? He just wants to listen to the radio.
I hand over
the keys, and then I wait, you know, in line, and I pay. And then I walk out and I see this car jump the cement, you know, bumper, and then...
Oh, you saw it! I didn't know you saw it!
Oh, I saw it, and I thought it was hilarious till I realized it was my car. I was like, oh, that's my car.
Look at this loser!
And then he slammed. I saw it lurch and jerk and slam into the door, and I saw your face, and you looked as white as a ghost, and I was like, all right. I have some emotions right now. I have some things I want to say. I don't think I should say them or do them. So I'm going to go the other way. So I took a walk, and instead of
you
going
did take a walk.
You,
I remember that.
I needed to take a walk and just and then by the time I got there, a nice crowd had gathered.
Yeah.
And they asked who the operator of the vehicle was or who was in charge. So I had to drive, like you said, along parallel. You know, driving there with all these people looking. I'm like, I'm not the one who did it, okay? I'm fixing this. Stop looking at me like I did.
It was too, and I was crouched in the seat so I couldn't be seen. Anyway, I appreciate that, Todd, for indulging me on that.
Mike, I just have to say how impressed I am. Now, I wasn't there, but how impressed I am on how you doubled down again and again and again. Like, it sounds like this wasn't just a single slip. This was like multiple actions were required from you in order to get the car to into the position that it ended up in. So
absolutely.
You didn't say, hey, like you said, let's just stop touching things. You're like, nope, I got to touch more stuff.
Let me try this one.
I'm impressed.
Let me try this one.
Yeah,
let's
exactly.
Hammer the gas again. Okay, break. Okay, break.
Perhaps and, harder. Perhaps if I push down on this harder, that will be helpful.
It literally was. There was about 9 actions that went into it, and if I had stopped at any point, none of it would have happened. So it's a truly impressive feat of stupidity on my part.
It's good that nobody was walking by, and it's good that I decided not to park in front of the glass window, because you would have gone right into the new releases.
Kids, Google what a video store is, or watch the Netflix documentary.
Watch the last Blockbuster that Guthrie plowed into. The last Jumbo Video. And
it was all downhill for the industry. Yeah, exactly.
That's
yeah,
what started it. People realized they were dangerous, that it wasn't safe to go rent a movie. Somebody might drive in there.
We're loosely affiliated with a hockey podcast, and you and I haven't chatted about hockey too much. I know we chat hoops from time to time. Do you get to watch the games? I know we played together, and you were a really good hockey player.
Thanks, Mike.
But we were all terrified to play you. But like, how did your hockey career go? And what's Do you have any hockey in your life now?
Not really. Loved the game. Played from the time I was 4 or 5. I think my dad coached me when I was 5, and it was half ice. And I remember one time, we would just switch positions, and I was in goalie at one point, and I made a stop, and then I shot it. Since it was half ice, and some of the kids had trouble skating at 5, it went through everybody, and then it got to the goalie, and the goalie fell down, and I scored. So it wasn't quite Ron Hextall, but it was half of an ice. And my dad came back and reported that I'd scored as a goalie. And then I just, got better, and I was big. And I think we played 82 games a season when I played for the Twins, I think when we were 11. And we won the city championships. And then all you got to do to become a provincial champion is go beat up on Brandon. So after winning the Winnipeg cities, it was pretty easy to go win in Brandon. So we became provincial championships. And, we had Steve Nicholson and Paul Bailey, and we had a good squad, and Jason Botterill was my line mate. I think I was right defense, and Botterill was left, and he ended up in the NHL, and so we had some good reach and some good length, and so it was a ton of fun. And I think I almost quit before that grade 11 year, just because it was taking up so much of my life, and I think I wanted to play more video games and hang out with my friends more and do other things that were a little more a little less rigorous with practices at 5 and practices at 10. So I think I told my dad I didn't want to play, and you know, I think he was going to miss the social group. I think he loved hanging out with those parents, but then I think the coach called and said, "Hey, I didn't see you at tryouts. What's going on? Would you think about coming back?" And I said, "All right, I'll give it one more year, and then I'm done." And so I'm glad I came back for that year. And I was also cognizant of the fact that I think when you turn 12, body checking starts, and a bunch of my teammates just couldn't wait to crush people. Like, I can't wait till next year where we're going to be able to hit people. I'm like, I don't want to hit people, and I'm damn sure that everyone's going to want to hit me. So I think I'm just going to bow out, because I'm going to take no joy in hitting people, and I think everyone's going to want to kill me. So why don't I just stop before body checking started, and then, you know, play a game like basketball that's supposed to be no contact, which is not exactly true.
So you live just outside of Seattle, and they're getting a brand new NHL team, the Kraken. So just from your perspective, is there a lot of buzz around the city? What are your thoughts? Do you like the name? We've chatted about the name a little bit here. We're of slightly differing views on the name Kraken. But so what's it like in the Seattle area right now?
I think there's a lot of excitement. I think the city has some hockey heritage, and I don't know how far back it dates, but I feel like we had, I think at some point, you know, whatever the Stanley Cup was affiliated with, maybe even before the NHL, I guess Seattle maybe had won the Stanley Cup in some league or some. So there's a hockey history here from back in the day, and I think in Philadelphia they used to joke that there was only 20,000 hockey fans in Philadelphia, but they all went to every game and they're all a sellout. So there's, you know, this is a city of several million people, and I wouldn't call it necessarily a hockey city, but there's, you know, the Thunder, the T-Birds have had quite a legacy, and there is a fan base here, and this is a great sports town, and people here are very supportive of whoever comes to town, whether it's the Sounders. They used to be A-League, and of course now they're MLS, and they're kind of a model franchise, I think, for, you know, how to do it right, and they've got a really rabid fan base, and so I think they're really going to love hockey. And I've always said how great hockey is live, that I think it's maybe the best sport to see in person as opposed to the product that you might get on television. I think some sports might be better on TV, whether it's football and you get the replays and you really get to see the action. I think basketball is great live because you get up close, but I think hockey, just to see the whole ice and to see the scope and to see the speed and how quickly those guys the shift changes and the hustle and the excitement of the building, I think there's nothing quite like live hockey. So I think once people get a taste of that, they're not going to be able to get enough. And there was enough interest. I think they had to prove a lot of things in order to get a franchise here. And one of them is there going to be enough interest in season tickets? And I think they blew past whatever projections they needed. There was more than enough interest there. And I think so I've got some friends that have some season tickets. So it's kind of like you don't necessarily want the boat. You want your friend to have the boat. So Other People's Yacht Club, the OPYC. This is the Other People's Hockey Club, the OPHC. So I'm just going to, you know, jump on the tram, take the ferry over and go see some games when I get invited. So there's a lot of excitement. I think I think they've been redoing the Key Arena. That's where the Sonics used to play. And it was a really, really nice building in a very right downtown location. And I think they've taken these couple of years to get it ready with some luxury boxes and some great dining options. So I think it's going to be an event, and I think people are going to really love it. And hopefully maybe we don't have the success of, you know, Las Vegas, where we go to the Stanley Cup finals in our first year. But I think with the expansion draft, I don't think you can protect as many guys. So I think you're not necessarily destined to be at the bottom. I think you can get some really good players with the expansion draft and hit the ground running. So I think it's actually I think it's not going to take this city very long to fall in love with the Kraken. I like the name. I think it's cool.
Okay, awesome. that was my because I love the name, and it's anything different. And Vaughn alluded to this in an earlier podcast. Anything that's different and just trying to be a little innovative. I think hockey needs more of that. So yeah, I think we're all on board with that. Vaughn and I talk a lot in terms of, because there's a lot of professional sport narratives. Where and Vaughn and I sit on our little podcast, and we talk about what we think it means or doesn't mean. And we thought, well, let's ask Todd. Todd's a professional athlete. And the biggest thing that gets us is there's always the narrative where it's like, oh, it's back-to-back. So on the back-to-back, the team, it's a huge disadvantage. Or they're home after a long road trip. even though there's a 2-day break. And again, we don't experience it. We don't go through the rigors of travel. We don't, all the things that go along with being a professional athlete, we don't experience. So it's tough to understand whether these narratives are true. And we just wondered, like, if you could shed some light on if there's any truth to that. Like, if you guys are cognizant of these sort of scheduling snafus when you're playing.
Yeah, I think that's a very good question. And I think a lot of it depends on, you know, who you are, how old you are, and what your role is. And so there's guys in the NBA now that are playing in their early 40s. And then there's, you know, guys that are coming out at 19, 20. So I think it affects everybody differently. And so I can only really speak to my experience and maybe what I saw from some of the veterans on our team. And, you know, the travel is probably even better than it was. You know, back in the day, guys were flying coach and they were having connections. And I'm just, you know, I'm watching some documents with, documentaries with Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and, you know, some of these old players and what they had to do, you know, just with the travel and it's just so much easier with charter. I mean, you get to the airport, and maybe everything's different now with COVID, of course, but, you know, we'd get to the airport 15, 20 minutes before the flight and, you know, park the car, walk right on the plane, get comfortable. We had specially configured, we didn't have our own plane. At the time, I think about half of the NBA teams had their own plane, and we just kind of used a specially configured fleet of 737s that had, you know, enough room for 12 people in the first class area. All the seats were first class on the whole plane. The players were in the front with 12 seats, and every second row of first class seats was removed. So there was plenty of leg room. The chairs could recline almost fully. So if you wanted to sleep, you could comfortably sleep. There was full size pillows. There was, you know, lots of food on board. And so as soon as the game is over, you're going right to the airport, and you could sleep, and, you know, maybe you get home at 2 a.m. But then the next day, at least for us, we would maybe have practice at 11 so you could sleep in and get your rest. And if it was a back-to-back, we wouldn't have a shoot around that morning. We would just come in and kind of do a walkthrough and maybe the hotel ballroom, maybe mark the court on the ground and do a walkthrough. So they're always cognizant of, you know, when you need rest, how far we're going, you know, what we do on our day off. And I think as a, you know, I was 23, I think, when I entered the NBA, and 27 when I was done, and so I was playing at most 10 minutes a game. So for me, it wasn't a big deal to be doing back-to-backs, to be going all out for 10 minutes and then have to play another 10 minutes. But if you're Allen Iverson and you're playing 43 out of 48 minutes, it could be a different story. Now, he was a special player who had tons of energy and led the league in minutes, so I don't think it ever really slowed him down. But, you know, some of the older guys, You see some rationing now in the NBA where maybe guys aren't playing so much in back-to-backs. But I think they do as much as they possibly can to get you ready to play. And I think some of these things are allowing players to play longer. They're more cognizant, I think, of their diets and their exercise regime, mm-hmm. and some, you know, whether they're in some barometric chamber at home to help heal. I think there's a lot known in terms of science. And so I think guys can – you know, football is another thing where they're playing once a week. So every sport's a little bit different. I know in hockey they get pretty banged up. I mean, basketball is a physical game, but not nearly to the extent that the NHL is. So I think it might be harder for those guys to play back-to-back after, you know, getting in a fight or getting crunched against the boards. And typically in basketball, you're going to get fouled, but those typical things probably aren't going to lead to injuries. You know, you're going to have plays where pop and break, but on a normal night, you're probably not going to be that dinged up. And so I think each game is unique.
So Mike and I talk a lot about coaching on this, and particularly some of the things that we think Paul Maurice, who's the head coach of the Winnipeg Jets, should be doing or shouldn't be doing. And I think that's a natural part about being a fan, but it's very much like, you know, from a bird's eye view, we're very much detached from the reality of being a part of a professional team. You had the opportunity to be coached by one of the best coaches in the history of the NBA, Larry Brown. But you had other coaches as well. From your perspective at the professional level, how important is coaching? And that, I guess perhaps it can vary if you have a veteran group or a young group, but how important is the role of the coach amongst professionals? And, you know, I would assume Coach Brown was the best coach you ever had, but maybe share some of the best things that he taught you.
No, that's a really good question. And just as a fan growing up, whether I was watching the NHL or watching the NBA, I didn't think the coach was really that important from a just from a casual fan's perspective. I think, you know, the players are out there doing it all. Why is the coach even that important? But after being, you know, being coached at every level and seeing especially at the pro level, how important it is to have somebody at the helm that has, you know, confidence and experience and is able to understand how each player needs to be motivated. And so you've got so many, everyone's a different person. Everyone has a different story. And at some point, everyone must have been a star at some level if they make it to the NBA. And so you've got to decide, okay, this guy needs to have his ego massaged a little bit. This guy needs a kick in the butt. This guy I can push only so far. This guy needs to be challenged. And so you really have to be a people person, I think, to understand how to get the most out of your players. And I think Coach Brown was great at that. He's a Hall of Fame coach, and I think he understood exactly what buttons he needed to push for which players to get the most out of them. And he had a way with people, and he also knew that he needed a great staff, so he had great assistants around him that might complement somebody that he could lean on at a timeout and say, okay, you know, who should I put in this situation? And so, you know, you need to do a good job to be ready not only for the coach to have confidence in you, but maybe in practice prove to some of the assistants that, you know, when coach is asking for their input, you know, who do I go to in this situation to be ready. And so I think, you know, Coach Brown would know that if we had 82 games in a season, there'd be a couple where you just don't have it. And instead of, you know, berating and going off and yelling and screaming, you know, sometimes you might come in the locker room and say, all right, guys, we didn't have it tonight. You know, in a season, there's going to be four or five games where we just don't have it. This is one of those nights. Let's get back tomorrow and let's work on it. So I think it's just, you know, realizing the experience of, are we, you know, do we have things that we need to change, or do we just have an off night? And, you know, it depends if you're an offensive coach or a defensive coach. And offense, sometimes the ball's not going to go in. It's just, you know, guys might have some shooting droughts. But on defense, that effort should be there. And they good coaches will say there's no cold nights on defense, and you've got to always be there and present. So I think the players really need to buy in, and they need to believe that the coach knows what they're talking about, and guys need to accept their role. So I think at one point, Coach Brown maybe said that three of the guys on his team, you know, who's the best player in the NBA? I am, coach. Who's the best player in the NBA? I am, coach. Who's the best player in the NBA? I am, coach. And he's like, I've got three guys on my team that say they're the best player in the NBA. How am I supposed to coach these guys? And so he found a way to do it. He found a way to share the ball and to call plays. And so I think you really have to get to know who your personnel is and how you can get the most out of them.
Yeah, and what kind of, like, what would, if a coach was saying, like, here's what I can do with Todd, or here's the push Todd needs? Because you had, like, you know, when you started out, obviously, like most players, you had limited minutes, but then, you know, in the Nets, you were a starter. So I'm sure that influences in terms of the more minutes you play, the more comfortable you feel, and maybe the less coaching you need. But were you a guy that needed that got yelled at, or were you more the, like, I'm always wary of the coach because I don't want to fall on the wrong side of this, so I'm gonna do what I told when I'm told of.
Yeah, I always tried to listen. I did not like getting yelled at. I tried to avoid it. I mean, there was, you know, sometimes where Coach Brown said I looked like I was running in mud, and you know, you only got one speed and it's not fast, so you sort of get the point that they're trying to make. And so I would try and pick it up, but I was not super tough. So I just really tried to learn the NBA game, and the NBA was, you know, a little bit different than college, and there was nobody better to teach than Coach Brown. He was a teacher, and he would have the young guys in there, whether they were the draft picks or the second round picks or the free agents, you know, playing 3-on-3 before practice, and we were, you know, getting a sweat, and Coach would break down the plays into you know, half court sets, and we'd be working on, and then the veterans would come up and they would get loose and we'd go through practice, and then coach would come back to working with us after practice. And so you kind of understood your role. And I wanted to, you know, try and please the coach and not get into trouble and listen. And, you know, sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't. I remember in Detroit playing the Pistons, and I hadn't played in a long time. And so sometimes I think human nature is you feel like, why should I be ready when I haven't played in 10 games? And so sometimes my concentration would waver a little bit, and I was looking up in the stands, and the mascot for the Pistons was about to ride a sled or a toboggan down the top row aisle, and I'm supposed to be watching the timeout, but I haven't played in 10 games, so I feel like I can just watch this mascot and Matt Geiger was kind of a mentor of mine, and he sees me all distracted. He comes over, and I think he's going to chastise me and tell me to get my head back in the timeout. And he's like, dude, you got to see this mascot, man. He's totally insane. This guy is nuts. You got to watch this. I'm like, okay. So I'm not the only one that's a little bit distracted. But you know, I think I started off shooting 2 out of 10 from the free throw line. I think in college I was somewhere maybe in the low 70s or high 60s, and I think I finished my NBA career at maybe 65%. Nothing great, but a lot better than the 20% it looked like when I'd only shot 10 free throws over the course yeah. of about 30 games, because I wasn't in any kind of rhythm. And then part of me, I came to practice and I saw that stat that I'm too, you know, Todd McCullough, 20% from free throw line. I thought, well, that's just not accurate. I know I'm not that bad, but I get no rhythm. And I thought, you know what's kind of cool is that, you know, Coach Brown is our professional coach, and we're professional players, and he knows that I'm working on it. He hasn't even mentioned it to me, right? And so he's not riding me about it. And, I've been working on it, and I'll be better when I get a chance. And he came out that day, and he's like, Todd, you know you're shooting 20% from the free throw line. That is unacceptable. Your stance, bro. I'm like, oh, no, he does notice. Yeah, he noticed. Okay, I'll work on it. So it's a complex thing, just the dynamic of, you know, a coach and the players and trying to, you know, meld them all. And you think everybody's probably got a pretty good contract and some other things that might be playing for themselves. And I fortunately landed in a couple. I only played for 2 teams, and both of them, you know, they knew who their roles were. We had defensive-minded teams. We knew who our stars were. Yeah. We knew where the shots were coming from, and we knew what it took to win. And I think people were willing to buy into that. And I think part of that was the general manager had assembled a team to complement Iverson and to, maybe fill in some of the blanks. So we didn't need a lot of help on scoring. And they went out and got, you know, team-minded players that could maybe play multiple positions. And so I think the front office has a big role as well.
Yeah, that's 100% true. And I think you touched upon one of the things that we talk about a little bit, and how easy it is to forget that these are human beings. They're not just, you know, they're not just functionaries that have a role, even though they need to buy into that role. These are human beings, and you coming from a truly unique path to the NBA, you know, from Winnipeg, Manitoba, all the way to Philadelphia, New Jersey, that is very atypical of the type of person you'd find in the NBA. Did your teammates even know you were Canadian? Or are there some good stories? Did they bust your chops about, you know, igloos and all the, you know, dumb things that we would think, the stereotypes, you know, a little bit of the human side of the game and how it interacted with you being this unique person in the context of the NBA?
Yeah, I got a little bit of that when I, you know, first got to college and met some, you know, a couple of my teammates from California, and they found out I was from Canada, and they were like, so do you guys have, like, Nintendo and Sega Genesis? I'm like, no, we're still on Pong up here. We don't have those things. So, I think a college coach came up to recruit me in Winnipeg, and he had some questions for my high school coach, and said, so coach, when I come there to watch Todd play, will there be telephones in Winnipeg where I can call? And I think coach is a little sarcastic. He's like, yeah, there's one telephone in the center of town. You'll find it.
It's right by the stoplight.
And, you know, will there be hotels? Will I be able to stay in a hotel up there? And, you know, how do I get to the high school? And I think coach said, just land at the airport, drive out, hang a left, you can't miss it. So he kind of, you know, messed with him a little bit. And, but, it, you know, I think in the NBA, I showed up and talked to the general manager and said, and I'd sort of asked Steve Nash, how does this work with, you know, with being Canadian, with a work visa, how does that happen? And I think he said that the don't worry, the team takes care of all that stuff. So when I first, you know, got to practice and said to the GM, so, do you have a work visa for me? Or he's like, what are you talking about? I'm like, well, I'm not from this country. I'm from a different country. And he's like, oh yeah, I should probably get on that. So, I think sometimes people, think that Canada's similar, but obviously there's some differences. And so, when I first got to University of Washington, I didn't know much about the UCLA's dominance and the, you know, with Kareem and all those championships under John Wooden. I didn't know who John Wooden was. My teammates couldn't believe that I'd never heard of John Wooden. And then when I was at Notre Dame, you know, taking a recruiting trip there, I I met Lou Holtz, and they said, "You met Coach Lou Holtz?" I'm like, "He must be an assistant or something." And they're like, "No, that's the guy." And I was like, "Really?"
Well, he's a tiny little man.
Yeah, he's a big, huge football player full of giants, and he was, you know, compared to me, he was short, and I didn't know anything about Notre Dame football, so I just, you know, probably made a fool of myself. But I went in, you know, I picked a basketball program, University of Washington, that was, I think, 5-23 that year, and had, you know, one of the worst teams in the Pac-10, and I picked it based on where I thought I'd be comfortable, which coach I liked, which teammates I liked on the recruiting trip, which city I liked, and it ended up being, you know, a good decision. But I kind of went into it maybe with some different criteria, and I, you know, I look back and I must have made some good choices. If you end up in the NBA, things must have worked out okay. But I wasn't necessarily, you know, I think the coach knew that I was not a, you know, not that tough, in the sense that, you know, I was skilled and I think I needed to toughen up, and I think they needed to handle me with kid gloves a little bit. And then, you know, coach in college would say, like, "Todd, you're a great kid. Parents did a good job raising you, but I need a little more effort. Can I get that from you, buddy?" I'm like, yes, you can. You've reassured me that I'm good enough, and my parents raised me well, and now I can work harder. You know, I'm sure it was just driving them crazy that I, you know, I maybe couldn't take some of the verbal abuse. And they realized, like, look, this is a very fragile flower, and we don't want to crush them. So if we just keep him going, he can help our team win. So they were they helped me, and I think I got tougher. I was never afraid between the lines to not necessarily mix it up, but I was always willing to take a foul.
No, you bang bodies down there.
People, you know, I got dunked on, but I was never trying to duck out of the picture to not get posterized. Yeah. So I, you know, if anything, I was maybe too aggressive. I think freshman year I fouled out in college in 6 minutes. And the coach said, "Todd, you've got to extend yourself. You've got to play more minutes." And the next night I fouled out in 7 minutes. I said, "Coach, how am I doing? I'm trending in the right direction.
Yes.
Like, coach, they were going to score. I had to stop him." He's like, "You can't stop everyone from scoring all the time. Stop fouling everybody." So I had to learn when to put my hands up and when to take a swipe.
So I thought we'd do, like, we're going to pick – we'll let you pick, because you have so many great stories. If you wanted to tell your any story you want, and then we thought, if it's okay with you, we have a running bit or a running trivia segment. But do you have a favorite story?
You've probably heard it, so I'll just but maybe Vaughn hasn't heard it. So I had a friend named Eftimios Rentsias, who was a Sixer, and we called him Rents for short, and he and I were, you know, good buddies, and we traveled together on the plane, and we were having a conversation, and it was during the playoffs, and he and I were spending a lot of time on the bench, and I think the front row, everybody had a letter, and it was W-H-O-O-Z-E-Y-E-R-D-A-D-D-Y, and Rentsia said, "Todd, what is Wahoozy your daddy?" And I said, "Oh, Rents, it's not, well, who's your daddy? It's actually phonetic. It's who's your daddy." "Yes, what means who's your daddy?" And I said, "Have you ever tried to explain who's your daddy?" I'm like, and I think I know. I'm like, "Oh, it's not who's-y, it's who's your daddy." And he's like, "Yes, what means who's your daddy?" I'm like, "I don't actually know. Like, I think we're their daddy. Like, I think we're their daddy. And maybe we're smacking them around, or I don't know. I think we're in an authority. I think we're beating them, like, in the basketball sense, like scoring, I think." And he's like, "Okay, I get, thanks." I'm like, I'm sorry. I don't know how to explain who's your daddy. I'll have to look at him and be like, no, it's good. I get." And then the next day I come into practice, and he's playing one-on-one with our coach, Mike Woodson, who is nicknamed Woody. And Rince is bombing threes, and he bombs a three. He's like, "Who's your daddy, Woody? That is exactly right. So I'm glad you understand who's your daddy now."
That's awesome. Okay, so my trivia question is, I've combined both NHL and NBA players, and it'll become readily apparent how they're grouped and why they're grouped the way they are. But the task for both yourself, Todd, and for Vaughn is to collectively determine, because I have a not so objective answer, but who is the best combo of these? So, number one, Steve Yzerman, Steve Nash. Number two, Paul Coffey, Paul Pierce. Number three, Joe Sakic, Joe Dumars. Number four, Ray Bourque, Ray Allen. And here's a bit of a twist. Number five, Michael Camilleri or Michael Jordan. So collectively, which of those name groups would you like their collective careers together? Right. Do you rank number one?
Who is A again?
I'm gonna. Steve. A was the Steves. That's who I'm going with. I'm going with Ivory, yeah. Iserman, and I'm going with Nash because they got it done. And I don't know Steve Iserman, but I know he was a great player, and I know he helped his team to some championships. And I know, unfortunately, Nash wasn't able to get that title as a player. Hopefully, he gets one as a coach. But he did everything else, and he's a 2-time MVP. And he's just an incredible competitor, incredible teammate. So I'm not voting against either of those guys.
Oh. Vaughn, that was yours too?
I'm known as the nice guy on this podcast. Mike's the angry guy. But yeah. So I am probably voted most likely just to agree with our guest. But I will actually – I agree with you 100%. It's got to be those two. Although, you know, it's tough to not – include Jordan in that, but
yeah,
the gap between Camilleri and Iserman is just too great for me. I think the gap between Jordan and Nash is a lot tighter than the gap between Iserman and Camilleri. So for me, I'm on board with you, 100%. It's got to be A.
Oh, that you guys. So you that was easier.
You were using math. You were using like deductive reasoning and the transitive property. This minus this guy equals this guy. So. I'm glad you saw the light. I just went with my gut, and you jumped on board. Yeah, that's fine.
I'm a giant nerd.
Do you still talk to Nash, Toddy? A little bit.
A little bit here and there. I just talked to another teammate of ours on the Olympic team, Sean Swords, and he's a coach at Laurentian University, and so he and Steve are good buddies, and with them both being coaches. You know, they've been communicating, and so I've kind of just been going, you know, through some of the other, players I know from the national team. And so I think Steve and I haven't talked in a little while, but I always appreciated when we would be either in Dallas or Phoenix or wherever he was playing, you know, he would always make time for me, and we'd go out for lunch and get caught up. And so I cool. miss the fact that there's not a team here in Seattle. I was really looking forward to moving back here with the Sonics and having people that I still know within basketball come to town and have some face to face time. Yeah. So I think he's doing great and he's got so much talent there. And I watched a little bit of the game against the Lakers yesterday. And so I wish him nothing but the best. And I think it could be very similar to some of the success that Steve Kerr had with a lot of talent to be able to manage those personalities. And, you know, if your coach says something, you can't look at him and be like, well, you don't know what you're talking about. You don't know this game.
Yeah,
if you're a 2-time MVP, you're a great player individually, but you also understand the team game and how to, you know, he really sees the whole court. So I loved playing with him, and I can only imagine that he's a player's coach and that people want to do what he's asking and try and get it done.
There's a ton of reasons to love Steve Nash. For me, he's also a huge Tottenham Hotspur fan, and that's the team I follow. So I know he's passionate
right.
about them, and
he's
a bit of a soccer player himself. And I'm really happy to see him having success in as a coach in it's Brooklyn, right? He's coaching.
He's a coach in the Brooklyn Nets, and he's always been very serious about his fitness. And his brother Marty was a great soccer player, and I think at some point was playing either pro over in England. And I think to some of Steve's relatives, they're like, what is this NBA? This is nothing. Marty is the real star in this family because he's playing pro soccer, so NBA schmNBA. So I think Steve had maybe arranged for Marty to do some off-season training and maybe set him up to work with his either strength and conditioning coach in the off-season and 5 o'clock workout or 6 o'clock workout, and they get done with a great workout, and that trainer said to Marty, so Steve's hooked us up, and I'm willing to put the time in. I'll be here at 6 a.m. every morning. I just need to make sure that you're on board. I think Marty was like, no, I don't think so. I think I'm done with the off-season training, and I'm just going to use my abilities and talents, and I'll get it done. So thanks, but no thanks. So babe.
All right. So my trivia question is a little bit more traditional. And we're doing a little bit of a right turn here. Now, typically, you may know the story about Mike and the Nick Antropov jersey. And so the theme for my question to Mike has been Nick Antropov up until now. But we're gonna change it up a little bit. The category this week is entitled That Goddamn Steen. Okay. Oh, a yeah. trivia category where, just like Jets 1.0, you'll find that Thomas Steen might not be the answer to the question. Okay. So I'm happy to announce that I've secured corporate sponsorship for this segment. Oh. My section is brought to you by First Mining Gold, the first name in gold. Well, the second name if you include gold member from Austin Powers.
I love gold!
So I'd also like to add that this segment is fully endorsed, funded, sanctioned, and legally protected by President and CEO of First Mining Gold, Dan Wilton, who we grew up with.
But shout out, Dan.
Shout out, Dan. All right, so here's my traditional question, and you guys can both have a shot at it. Who was the Jets 1.0 all-time leading scorer? Was it Thomas Steen, Paul McClain, Keith Kachuk, or Dale Hawerchuk? Jets 1.0 all-time leading scorer, so goals and assists.
I got to go Hawerchuk, just because just from name recognition. So right or wrong, that's my guess.
That would be my first thought, but I know Vaughn well, and there's a twist here, because Steen was around forever, and he was always kind of a perennial 30 goal scorer. I'm going Thomas Steen.
Dale Hawerchuk.
Todd
is 2 for 2. Dale Hawerchuk racked up 379 goals and 929 points in 713 games over 9 seasons. Thomas Steen, 817 points in 950 games for Jets 1.0. So the trick, you're right, Mike, there was a catch, and it was in the opener when I said, you'll find that Thomas Steen might not be the answer.
Yeah, you anchored me. As soon as I heard Thomas Steen, I was like, I'm going to go crawl in a corner somewhere, lick my wounds. That was slightly embarrassing.
Todd is a professional, the ranked number one on this podcast. It's a very low bar.
Yeah.
But he comes on, he tells stories about international success, championships in multiple sports, and he kills it on the trivia.
We are
absolutely humbled to be in your presence.
Oh, I'm happy to be here with you guys.
Well, we could go for hours and hours, but I did want to just sort of the final thing, as a couple very, very amateur podcasters, I know that you spent some time calling games for the 76ers. Any tips for us other than to stop right now?
Other than quit now. No. Don't just say quit now.
I think you guys are you're doing great. I think you've got what's important. You've got love. You've got passion. You've got chemistry. And, you know, you don't take yourselves that seriously. I mean, you have to have, some reason for people. You know, it can't just be all jokes and laughs. But I think it can be entertaining. I think your show is. And so I think you just keep on going with what you're doing. And I think, you know, you had me on here today, even though I'm not that up on the Winnipeg Jets scene currently. But I think you just kind of opened the door and made me feel welcome. And you're well prepared, and you had some good trivia questions, and you let me tell a story. Do you have time for one more story? It's not
absolutely.
It's not really it's not a funny story, but it is a hockey story. So when I first got to the when I first got to the Sixers, Ed Snyder was the owner and chairman of both the Flyers and the Sixers. And do you guys know the story of how he started the Flyers? Do you guys know that?
No.
So I think he was, maybe the chairman or the CEO of Comcast, and I think that was his business in communications. And so I think he was up in Boston with a friend of his, and this was when the original Six were the only teams. And I think there was a lineup around the block for wherever the Bruins were playing. And he said to his friend, like, what's this all about? Well, the Boston Bruins are playing, one of those other five teams. And he said, can we go? And so they got in line and they went. And like a lot of people, he was blown away by the game and being there in person. He said, this is what I want to do. I'm going to start it. I'm going to breathe the team into existence. I'm going to make team number 7. I think 7 and 8 maybe came in at the same time. And so I think the Flyers are maybe credited with a 7th team. And he got it done, and he built the Spectrum with his own money without needing taxpayers' money. And all of a sudden, there was this team, and they were the Flyers, and they were his baby because he brought them into existence. And so at some point, I think the Sixers became for sale, and his corporation was in a position to also acquire the Sixers. So he owned both. And so he was always great to us. And I think he found out that at some point I'd played hockey as a youngster at a high level and said, hey, would you ever want to skate with my guys, with the Flyers? And I'm thinking, like, that would be an absolute dream come true. I mean, as a kid in Winnipeg, all, you know, I used to dream about the NHL and didn't know much about the NBA. And so I thought, this is an opportunity to, you know, really realize a dream. If I could get on the ice and take shots on an NHL goalie and maybe run some three-man weave, you know, and I knew that I used to be good, but that was back when I was 11 or 12. Way taller, different center of gravity, way heavier, and I also have size 19 feet. So I think I maybe hadn't had skates since I was maybe 13, 14. And so I said, you know, I'd love to, but I don't have skates. And he's like, you leave that to me. And so he got the marketing department to try and drum up some skates. And I think the Hasbeek family in Winnipeg, which I think was maybe the son of our neighbors in Leonard Woods, had a hockey shop and said, I can take a size 15 set of Bowers and I can stretch them with the European ski stretching machine and get them to, you know, get them to 17 or 19 and we'll ship them down to you. So I got the skates and the owner gave them to me and said, all right, practice up. You know, we've got a date. You're going to skate with my Flyers on this day in New Jersey and it's on the books. And I couldn't wait. So I went to a rink they had maybe rented for me or let me practice in. It was just me. And I put on these brand new skates that fit. And I go out there and I'm an ankle bender and I can't skate. And I'm like, I'm supposed to be skating with an NHL team here pretty quick. And I'm like the kid I used to make fun of and the Zamboni driver, the person at the rink said, those are nice skates. You ever had them sharpened? I said, no. And he's like, come here, numb nuts.
Really?
Skates. Yeah. So he sharpened them up. And then I'm like, oh, okay, this is a little better. And I slowly got better. And then I think my wife and I went for a second practice session and I was starting to get my groove a little bit and start to move and shoot some slap shots. And then the day was coming. We'd gone on a road trip and unfortunately we had a really high expectations. I think the team had made the second round of playoffs the previous year and we were expected to improve. And we started 0-4 on the road and came back and the crowd wasn't happy. The coach wasn't happy. Nobody's happy. So we were supposed to have a 2-hour practice and then I was supposed to jump in my car and, you know, Ed Snyder had said to the Flyers, like, hey, one of my basketball players is coming over to skate with you guys. If you don't mind sticking around after practice. And I think maybe 13 of the 15 guys maybe hung around practice for an extra hour waiting for me. But our coach was so frustrated with our 0-4 road trip that he wasn't about to end practice at the 2-hour mark. So we ended up having a 4-hour practice and I missed, The longest practice of my life had to be the day when I had a day with the Flyers. And so I missed my opportunity. And, you know, it wasn't Coach Brown's fault. He didn't know I had the job comes first. And I think the owner had our PR director on the phone saying, I'm here, wait for him. Where's Todd? And it's like, well, he's in practice right now. And Coach Brown is not about to stop. So USA Today, I think, had written an article about how the skate was going to happen. And so I saw Coach Brown the following week and he's like, hey, I read about that skate with the Flyers. How was that? And I'm like, I didn't get to do it. Why not? Well, we had a scheduling difficulty, so I didn't want to make him feel bad. He was just trying to make our team better. And I, you know, at that time I was still healthy, feet were good. I thought we would just reschedule and it wouldn't be the end of the world. But then I think I was left Philly after that year. And then when I came back to the Sixers, we were going to do it and had some foot problems. So unfortunately I never got a chance to get on the ice with the Flyers, but I remember being super excited for an opportunity, and it just didn't happen.
Oh,
what a great story!
That's an amazing story. And if you know when you're in Winnipeg visiting, we'll lace them up. If you still have those skates, we'll get out there fire some shots around. I'd love that.
Yeah, I almost tried to skate, and I was in pretty good shape then. That's when I was active with the Sixers, so I was a lot heavier than I was when I was 11. I'm a lot heavier than I was during your playing day. So I tried to put the skates on a couple of years ago and I was going to fall and break my ankle and never get up. I'm like, I'm just going to get my butt off this ice before something bad happens. So
we'll go to a Jets game then.
Yeah,
I'm good at eating hot dogs and watching.
We'll have a Jets dog. They're fantastic.
And you guys might have to come watch the Kraken here for a little West Coast road trip.
That would be road trip. Call it right now. Well, Toddy, I really, really appreciate it. I can't thank you enough. And, you know, I'm hoping, well, I know that our many, many listeners are going to be delighted to hear you and to hear your wonderful stories. So I, again, I can't thank you enough.
Thanks, man. It's been fun. Keep up the good work, and you know, you guys are passionate about the Jets, and I hope they go all the way. I jumped on the bandwagon hard when they were looking like they were gonna make it to the Stanley Cup final. So I watched most of those games. So I'm definitely a bandwagon fan. If they can get back to the playoffs, I'll be watching them and rooting for them. So I want that for you guys. I want them to go far.
Perfect. Thanks, buddy. Awesome. Well, that was fantastic. Again, thank you, Todd. Really appreciate it.
Yeah.
I learned a bunch, and you know, I think one of the common themes there was that you and I, Vaughn, talk about what we think are the do's and don'ts of being a professional athlete. So it's nice to actually have a real professional athlete on to give us his perspective.
Yeah, and that was exactly the point of it. I mean, I think first and foremost it was for you and for us to connect with someone that you grew up with and remain very close to, who was also a professional athlete and kind of can bring that perspective to our little discussions we have here.
Well, summer's coming up, and we're always sensitive to Manitoba-run businesses, and we were approached by just a fantastic new amusement park that's coming up this summer, so give it a listen.
Hey kids, summer's coming, and Manitoba's newest attraction is Tinkletown. We brought all the worst kids' activities together in one giant petri dish of an amusement park. You're welcome, parents. Enjoy the water slides that are now FDA-approved and certified 40% urine. Seriously, we didn't even put bathrooms in this place. We promise the lines will be super long and that the 12-year-old lifeguard can't even spell CPR. Feeling waterlogged and you've hit your ammonia limit for the day? Come check out the petting zoo. Careful though, half the animals bite, but the fun is guessing which ones do. Next, get ready to spend $80 in under 5 minutes with our carnival games. The newly released felon working the booth will show you how to win, even though it's a near impossibility. You won? Congrats! Here's a stuffed snake that your child will leave on a sticky picnic table after lunch. Parents, don't think we've forgotten about you. Come soak in the public hot tub, which is just like a bath with strangers, but with scummy bubbles. You've decided to have kids, or maybe you didn't, so you have to come to Tinkletown, because your kids will insist upon it. That's our entire business model. Tinkletown. It's as bad as it sounds. Not affiliated with Tinkertown.
So we'll carry on. Check-in time. Okay. So 3-0 by all accounts. I'm not a actuary major. That's a good week. And I thought, you know, breaking it down game by game, but there were a few things that I thought that developed over the course of the week that we can touch base on, but I thought that we, with Wheeler gone and some question marks at defense, I thought we, especially in the last game, I think we accounted for ourselves pretty well.
Yeah, it was a really good week. Not a lot to pick at in terms of, you know, things to complain about. You could question a little bit the level of competition we had that week. I think we're going into a stretch where we're going to be playing very, very competitive teams. I think we got 7 games in a row that's going to be either Toronto or Edmonton. But the point, I think, of this week was we need to get the points this week. Like, because we have that tough spell coming up, we can't afford to give away any free points this week. And the Jets didn't. They took 6 of 6 points.
We tried.
Yeah, we tried. I do think our level of play was better than what was reflected in the scores, especially the first two games. I mean, the 5-0 game maybe flattered us a little.
Yeah.
But the Ottawa score, I thought we were far more in control of that game.
That's fair.
Than
yeah.
what the score reflected. And even the 4-2 game, they got that very, very fortuitous bounce to get their second goal. I thought we had more control over that game than the score indicated. You know, a good week. What did you think?
I agree. There were a few things, again, that I wanted to touch base on. The first being, and again, I'm just throwing this out as a question more than a statement, but I had thought, or maybe had anticipated, that with Wheeler out, that we would team up Ehlers, Kopp, and Stastny.
like both from an eye test and a 5-on-5 expected goals, any sort of advanced stat that you reference, they were really good. And they're good together. Again, a small sample size, but they're our highest rated line this season. And I know there's been some rumblings that, you know, we're gonna throw a bunch of stuff at the wall and see what sticks. And yeah. To a certain extent, I get that. You wanna test everything out to see what you have moving forward. I know what the Ehlers, Connor, and Scheifele line looks like. It can be really good, and then it can be deficient at times. But am I simplifying it too much to think that maybe we give that line a go? And if it's something that it sticks, I understand once Wheeler comes back, it gums everything up. But it does, to me, it did work. So I didn't understand why we didn't try it at least once or for a period or something.
The only thing I can think of is that we know how they will play together. So we wanted to take the opportunity to try other combinations, because I do think there's an eye to that 7-game stretch where, you know, we're going to play well in some of those games, and in some of those games we're not going to play well because the level of our competition is as high as it can be in this division. So perhaps Maurice was looking for some additional information, some data on who could work together well for those times where, you know, he doesn't like the line match, or we need a spark in the play and he needs to switch up the lines. And that the impetus to that certainly was Wheeler being out, but maybe it wasn't the right time to go back to what you know best. It was time to experiment. I have to admit, Mike, I didn't put as much thought into it as I think you did. I thought that, you know, I like our lineup. I think the loss of Wheeler, and I do think it was bigger. It wasn't as big as what some people were suggesting, and bigger than what other people suggested, especially in, I think, the medium term and its potential impact on the power play situation. But I thought it was a very survivable omission.
Yeah, and fair enough, we played pretty well, especially in the Ottawa game. That was the one, like, it's so nice. And again, I'm not picking on Ottawa, but just the when we have space to freewheel, we're a pretty hockey team. It is fun to watch. And I just enjoyed that whole game. And then, obviously, the two games against Montreal, it's much, much tighter checking. The spaces are cut exponentially. And it's a grind, right? And there were large swaths of even especially the third game that were not the most entertaining brand of hockey in the world, but because both teams are trying to do that purposely, it jumped out to me when we started playing Ottawa. I was like, oh my goodness, look at the space. Like, we're really clever with the puck. We're less so without it. And I guess the only other thing was I didn't understand. And again, I promise I'm not picking on anybody, but like putting Appleton on the power play in Wheeler's spot and just keeping the same strategy, I didn't understand that to a certain extent. Like, Wheeler's there because he's very gifted, and he has the full skill set to basically act as quarterback back there. That's not Appleton's role. That's not Appleton's skill set. I get that they switched it up, that Scheifele was sort of QBing everything. I just figured that with Wheeler out, you just cut your loss, right? Like, let's go maybe a little more traditional, get Appleton wheeling around in the corners, digging pucks out. But I don't know, did that bug you?
No, not at all. I think it was a reward to Appleton for having played so well up until this time. And I do think that simply by putting him in there, it's the least disruptive to that group. So again, I don't think what you're suggesting is outside the realm of logical, but I just saw it as we want to keep things as standard as possible for this group, and we're going to reward this guy who's had a really good season up until now. Now, back to the Ottawa thing, let me tell you, I completely respect that Ottawa has fully adopted chaos as both an offensive and defensive system. Okay, I'm reminded of that timeless line from Justin Bateman in the movie Dodgeball. That's a bold strategy, Cotton. Let's see if it pays off for them.
Ouch, town population, you, bro!
Speaking of chaos, I thought Brady Tkachuk, who's the Tkachuk I like better, okay, he was a little too much like his brother in that game. And I know that, you know, Wheeler's now concussed. you know, but it's typically Brady is the one that plays just close to or only slightly over the line. You know, Matthew, on the other hand, from Calgary Flames, he's gone full landlord COVID edition and bought multiple pieces of property from Jared Kushner on the wrong side of the line. Like, he lives on that line. I really like a tweet I saw. I wish I would attribute this, but I can't remember who came up with it. But it described the difference between Brady and Matthew, which said Brady is the type would have been the type of kid to spray paint the principal's car, whereas Matthew would have wanted to ruin his marriage. Like, there's just a fundamental difference. Like, but yeah, we saw more. I thought Brady was being a complete jerk. What did you think?
Yeah, I do too. And it's tough for me to distinguish which one of them I dislike more. But Matthew definitely is a little Machiavellian in his tactics and the way he plays. And I love that tweet. I'm going to Google that after. But yeah, and I thought we responded well in each game to adversity as we usually do. I think we're going to have to. There was some glaring game two, game three. The offensive giveaways are something that I think, you know, come playoff time and, like you say, the schedule getting a lot more difficult. We're just not going to be able to get away with that without, like, if you do that against Matthews and Marner and that crew, you're going to get a lot of goals scored on it. I don't know why it struck me, but there were just so many neutral ice, even in our own end, and then offensive zone giveaways that led to scoring chances where I was like, you know, we still got some time, but that needs cleaning up if we have any hope of making a run in the playoffs.
I agree. And here's what I'll say. I did notice the same thing. I do think that, you know, with the chaos approach of Ottawa, you can never really predict. Like, it's not discernible what's happening in front of you. So, you know, suddenly there's a guy in front of you that shouldn't be there. So that could have been part of it in the Ottawa game. And I do think Montreal does a really good job of clogging the lanes. And I felt we were guilty of overpassing at times. We were trying to make lot of nice, fancy little plays. And I agree that, you know, that's not going to serve us well. But, you know, Montreal's a pretty good defensive team. That was at times some pretty boring low event hockey those two games. But again, three games in which the Jets scored, you know, four or more goals and they were, you know, 3-0. So that narrative is still playing out. And that
fortuitous
game, the game against Montreal, the first period was a microcosm of the year. Like, we were completely outshot, but our elite shooting percentage puts us up 3-0 at the end of that first period. And I'm not sure we deserve to be there, but we're just going to keep riding this this elite shooting percentage wave, and I don't know how far it's going to take us, but I'm enjoying it while it lasts.
It's exciting. Should we do some pre-boarding announcements? We'll start with first class.
I have one seat in first class and one in coach. The price is the same because your flight was canceled.
Oh, well, I'll take the first class.
What? Why should you get the first class?
Elaine, have you ever flown first class?
No.
All right, then. See, you don't know what you're missing. I've flown first class, Elaine. I can't go back to coach. I can't. I won't.
I think you went first last week. I'm going to go. I got to do an honorable mention because I did Matthew Perreault last week, and I had him penciled in for this week because I have a bit of a man crush, and I did a bit of deep dive into the stats, and those are also exceptional. But I'm gonna give it to the oft maligned J-Mo.
Are we doing the penalty box, or are we doing first class assignments?
No, we're doing first class assignments.
Kidding. I'm kidding.
Yeah. I thought he has. There are still once, twice, three times a game where just decisions that are made with a puck, where I'm like, "Woo! I don't know what you were seeing there." But I think he's gotten comfortable about when to pinch, when not to pinch. I think he's making a better percentage of high probability passes in all the zones. I quite just, you know, flat out, I think he's looked better, and he had the beautiful goal. And I see the difference. Obviously, there's still some rough edges, and the advanced stats back that up. He's been better over the past 2-3 weeks. And so in the spirit of not picking on him too much, I thought, well, I'm gonna promote him to first class.
Well, I don't have an issue with that, and I completely agree. I do think he's been playing better. And you're right. I mean, there's still some mistakes in his game. I don't think he's still at that shutdown level yet, but he has been much better in moving the puck, moving his feet. He seems to be finding his game, so I like the pick. So for my first-class assignment, I also am going to pick a defenseman. And kind of like you, this is a little bit more of a season acknowledgement. Dylan DeMello, I'm going to put in first class.
Good stuff.
Yeah, he's been a massive stabilizing force on the back end. Yep. And, you know, with this reemergence of JMO and this great stabilizing force of DeMello, you know, our defenders and our team defense has been much more competent lately. I mean, we're still all over the place with high danger chances.
Yeah.
I've started to look at that. I found a website where, you know, I'm adding to my spreadsheet, Mike. I'm adding to my spreadsheet. So
all right there, Russell. Good job. Yeah,
there'll be new columns and colors and something to report on. But, you know, we're all over the place on high danger chances from game to game. But I do think I echo your sentiments that we've been much better defensively, and the play of our defenders has been much better. So I think it's entirely appropriate that we each selected a defenseman to bump up into first class.
Yeah, and DeMello is polarizing just in terms of Jets fandom. You'll run the full gambit, right? Like there are folks who think he's by far and away our best defenseman. There are folks who think he's terrible and should get limited minutes. And I throughout the year had been somewhat in the middle, but you know, like anything, I thought, well, in order to form a real opinion, let's watch him. And you're right. You've said it perfectly. He's just really solid back there. And the majority of the time he makes the right play. He's not flashy. He's not big, but it's a stabilizing presence back there, so I fully endorse that choice.
Yeah, you know, one thing I should also mention about DeMello, or Demo, as I like to call him. Demo has been really effective in supporting the play of Stanley, and Stanley's a guy I'm liking more and more.
Yeah.
I mean, he's not going to be in our top pair. He's not going to be in our second pair, but you still need a 5-6 defenseman, right? You need those guys. He brings some size. He's pretty adequate back there. You know, you look at, you know, if Stanley can develop by playing with a guy like DeMello to the point where Stanley is a bona fide NHL-er, albeit a third-pairing guy, you know, that gives me a lot of excitement for the other things I hear about Ainola, who's apparently the best defenseman in the AHL.
Yeah,
and Sandberg, who everyone says is going to exceed whatever Stanley is going to be. And we have, you know, Josh Morrissey, JMO. And that makes me excited for the future.
It makes me excited. But if we have another player that can be abbreviated, then I might quit this podcast.
I'm out of here.
Because if I have to hear any more DMOs and JMOs.
And
Scheif. Okay, so who are we going to assign to the penalty box this week?
You do that, you go to the box, you know, 2 minutes by yourself, and you feel shame, you know, and then you get free.
Do we have anyone this week, with them being 3-0?
Okay, well, I guess when you go 3-0, and you have some crushing wins, nobody gets the penalty box. Congratulations, Winnipeg Jets.
And just like that, we're on to the last call.
Hey, guys. Just letting you know it's last call. Almost time to wrap it up.
Okay. What's on tap for this week, Vaughn?
All right. We got 4 games between now and next Sunday, which is the next time we'll probably do the podcast. We got 2 games against Ottawa on Monday and Wednesday, a game against Toronto on Thursday, and then the Oilers on Saturday. So that game on Thursday starts that 7-game stretch that we talked about before, where they're playing Toronto or Edmonton, and it's going to be, you know, that's going to be a defining period for where we end up. But I do think these 2 games against Ottawa is important. We need to pick up the points. We're 5-1 against the Senators so far this season, so I think those are important games. I'm looking forward to continued chaos in high event hockey, which is, I think, what you can expect against Ottawa. So, you know, we're 2 wins, 3 losses with a shootout loss against the Leafs so far this year. So it'll be interesting to see that game because, like I said, that's going to start the 7-game stretch, and we're really going to understand who we are after that 7-game stretch.
I like it. I'm worried about losing just a, you know, a one-off or a bad one to Ottawa because I think, obviously, as you put it, our margin for error is pretty slim if we want to maintain the, you know, I think the race for second place, I don't want to be defeatist, but I think the odds or chances of lapping Toronto here in first, they're rolling, right? Like, I'm, again, not to be Debbie Downer, but I think the, and again, whether 2-3, I don't think it really makes a difference, but it would be nice to pick up a win in those last two games. So I'm going optimistic this week. I think we're going to go 3-1.
Oh, that's awesome. One thing I should mention is that Toronto game on Thursday is the back end of a back-to-back game. So we play in Ottawa on Wednesday
right.
and in Toronto. Right. So not a ton of travel, but back-to-back nights. You're playing the better of the two teams on the second night. You know, I would think that Hellebuck plays Monday, Thursday, Saturday. We see Brassois on Wednesday against the Senators, especially if we win that game on Monday. I think we can win at least a couple games this week, but I'm a realist. I'm going to go 2 wins, 1 loss, and 1 shootout loss, 5 of 8 points. I think we get 5 of 8 points this week.
All right. I like it. Well, again, like we said, a bit of an abbreviated analysis today because we were, again, very lucky and fortunate to have Todd McCall on our show.
It put a lot of the research I had for this episode into next week, so...
Oh, get ready for it. Can I ask for a chartreuse whenever you're putting your spreadsheets together? I like the color chartreuse, and we're running out of colors anyway on your...
Chartreuse,
your beautiful
mining. Is that...
I don't even know what
you have all the meats and the cheeses and the.
Yes, that's it. I didn't get that at first. I was like, "Oh yeah, that's right. He's talking about a charcuterie board."
Yeah, well played. Or whatever. Okay, so fellow travelers, that's it for this episode of the podcast. Thanks for listening, and be sure to come back next week to the Airport Lounge because the first round is always on us. Until then, go Jets, go!
Heads up, Landers.